If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's PAIR.com.
Welcome to this episode of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, in which we recognize that only by understanding the past can we understand the present. And the histories of Cuba and Haiti have very stark lessons to impart about the cruelty of the Cuba embargo, the repercussions of imperial exploitation, and the dangers that arise amid dysfunctional democracy. Sources today include Revolutionary Left Radio, Deconstructed, Democracy Now!, The Majority Report, and The Real News, with additional members-only clips from Rev Left Radio and Bad Faith.
Now, you did mention the current protests, and that's a good segue to this next question, because in Cuba recently, there has been this flare-up of protests rooted in the dire economic conditions within Cuba, largely, if not wholly, due to the multi-decade-long suffocating trade embargo on the island. The U.S. empire has always had a strategy of sanctions as war and of making the economy scream as a way of undermining nations that they want to destroy, and their economic and political hegemon status has always allowed them the power to do so. So I know you touched on it a little bit, but maybe there's more to say here. How do you all think about this situation, and where do you see Cuba going in the coming years?
I mean, what's happening now is simply a repeat of what happened in July 11th. Like, people in Cuba are legitimately suffering, and they're taking to the streets saying, we want power, we want food, we want fuel. And the reason why there is a severe shortage of those things in Cuba is a direct consequence of U.S. policy towards Cuba, the economic blockade, the placement of Cuba on the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism, which, first of all, is absurd, but second of all, cuts off Cuba from access to global banking. Like, they can't even get loans to engage in basic financial transactions on an international scale. They don't have oil reserves. They import a lot of their food. So if they can't get loans, they literally cannot buy those things. This is like a direct consequence of U.S. policy. And it's also very important to understand, this is the intent of U.S. policy towards Cuba. I think that folks are probably familiar with the memo written by Lester D. Mallory, who I believe was Assistant Secretary of State in the Kennedy administration, where he straight up says that the intent of the U.S. blockade on Cuba is to cause suffering among the Cuban people, to make them so hungry, to make them suffer so much that they rise up and overthrow their government, overthrow their revolution. So understand, when we're talking about the blockade, when we're talking about economic sanctions against places like Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, Zimbabwe, a third of the Earth's population living under some form of economic sanctions by the U.S., when we talk about those sanctions, we are talking about a strategy which is directly targeting civilian populations, making them suffer as much as possible. This is why the Trump administration waited for the COVID-19 pandemic to escalate the U.S. blockade on Cuba. This is why the same thing happened to Iran. The Trump administration escalated sanctions on Iran during the COVID-19 pandemic. Mm-hmm. They wait for moments when populations are suffering and they're like, this is our chance to make it even worse, because they want to destabilize the nation. They want the people to suffer so much that they rise up. And so this is what we have to understand about the intent of U.S. policy, the intent to specifically target civilians. And so if we're talking about wanting to be in solidarity with Cuba, if we're confused liberals talking about human rights in Cuba, we have to recognize primary criminal, the primary person or entity targeting Cuban human rights is in fact the U.S. government, is in fact U.S. policy towards Cuba in the form of the blockade. And I think this is something that, as anti-imperialists, we have to make people understand, be relentless about explaining that sanctions are about targeting civilian populations, specifically the most marginalized sectors of those populations.
Yes. Wonderfully said. And I recently left our sister podcast, Guerrilla History, but we've done an entire series over the last 3 years called Sanctions as War, in which we do case study after case study after case study, showing the details of how this sort of approach is applied to countries, what it does to the countries. And yeah, it's targeting civilians. It's ensuring that people don't have food and fuel and medicine. And they do it to Venezuela. They do it to Cuba. They do it to a million places. And when those places inevitably begin to struggle, they smugly point at them and say, see, socialism doesn't work. It's literally grotesque. It's straight up evil. It's beyond mere political terms. It is evil in every sense of the word, because beyond just hurting a political establishment or a political elite, it is meant, consciously meant, to terrorize and brutalize human beings. Children who need food, mothers and fathers who need to feed their kids, those are the primary targets of sanctions, even though they're often presented to us as just a nonviolent form of pressure campaigns on quote-unquote authoritarian governments, etc. So seeing through that and educating people to see through that, I think is absolutely crucial, and you're all doing that really important work. Musa, you had something to say?
Yeah, I got a few things on this question. But one, I think it was on Rev Left Radio, I listened to an episode about sanctions as siege warfare. And I had not given much thought into this notion of siege warfare and what it looked like in contemporary times. But it was a really phenomenal way of thinking about sanctions, because Pan-Africanists, we always say that the blockade is warfare. It is a direct form of warfare, economic warfare. It's also a form of underdevelopment. But I think I'm always trying to stress to people the urgency of the situation. And I think that in our heads, sometimes we categorize things as this over here is an acute situation. And then this thing over here, oh, it's been going on for 65 years, so they can hold on a little bit longer. And I want people to really understand what it means to be under a total dominance campaign under the form of a blockade for over 65 years. What that does to underdevelop the capacity of a state to pave roads, to fix buildings. In hospitals and pharmacies, the shelves are bare. My comrades, they ask me for things like ibuprofen, a condom can cost more than a year's worth of your salary because they're so hard to come by in Cuba. I know someone who is a psychologist herself, a very renowned Cuban psychologist, who had a surgery two summers ago, and she had to bring gloves and PPE, like a mask, for the doctor at the hospital to use because the hospital was completely out and they didn't know when they were going to get their next shipment. A friend of mine, a really, really close friend of mine who lives with HIV, he's supposed to get a special meal from the government with his rations, a special food supply, a diet meant specifically for him. And he has not been able to get that in 3 years because Cuba provides rations of rice and coffee and beans and sugar and these things to their people. And in their public health system, they create special diets for people who might have HIV, people who are elderly or anemic, or birthing people who are pregnant. And the capacity and ability to do all of this is grinding to a standstill more and more every single day. People who I have known for 10 years, every time I travel to the island, their faces are a little bit skinnier and a little bit more gaunt. And it's something that we're just not supposed to talk about. And, you know, I just can't stress enough the urgency. We've had 36 years in a row of the only countries voting against ending the blockade is the U.S., Israel, and then sometimes Ukraine.
The U.S. has tightened sanctions. Trump went full, like, maximum pressure sanctions, not just in terms of putting Cuba back on the international list of, like, state sponsors of terrorism, which was an entirely, nakedly, disgustingly clear case of politics. They did it right before they left office as a way to impede the Democrats from being able to, like, return to kind of a, like, an Obama era policy. It was like a very, like, you know, finger in their eye kind of thing. It was politics. But it's also the fact that Trump had activated Title III of Helms-Burton. And Helms-Burton is this law that was passed in the 1990s that really strengthened the embargo and gave the U.S. government the capacity to really go after foreign companies that trade with Cuba, but also trade with the U.S. and sanction them. And among other things, it had a section which is called Title III, which had never until Trump been activated, even under Bush. Even under Bush with Bolton there, you know, the most hawkiest guy you can imagine, even they never activated Title III. Title III allows U.S. citizens to sue people who trade or benefit from their assets that were nationalized in Cuba. So, for example, if you have a cruise ship and it docks in the port and the heir to that dock is still alive and he's a U.S. citizen, guess what? You're about to get a lawsuit in the millions and millions of dollars by a very litigious, very angry, and very well-funded Cuban-American with the full backing of the U.S. government behind him if he wins.
Some of these judgments have reached into the billions of dollars, and they're seizing Cuban assets all over the world. What's been the economic impact of that?
Well, I mean, there's no more cruise ships, among other things. When I left Cuba in 2013, cruise ships hadn't become big yet. When I visited again in 2018, I knew multiple people who were making a living off of very short-term, like, cruise ship tourism. The Americans or the Italians or whatever would be let out at the port. And every day there was a new ship. And they wouldn't spend a ton of money individually, but collectively, a lot of people were able to work the tourism trade by serving as guides, whatever. And then, of course, they took that money and then they consumed and they made jobs for other people. So that was a huge influx of cash for the country. And cruise ships are dead. The hotels, you know, at night, you'll see one or two rooms in use, but they're mostly empty in what's supposed to be part of the high season. It's been devastating. And because that's a source of key foreign currency, and Cuba imports 60 to 80% of all of the food it consumes, that's bad.
And so the Trump administration did this maliciously on the way out, trying to reverse the Obama administration's policy. And I've done some reporting on this particular piece. The Biden administration indicated to Democrats in Congress that they were reviewing whether, you know, Cuba actually belonged on this state sponsor of terror list that the Trump administration put them on right before they left. Not that long ago, in a private meeting, the State Department informed some members of Congress, oh, actually, that review hasn't even started.
Oh, Jesus.
Which just absolutely shocked everybody in the room, because once it starts, then other things kick in. It, you know, statutorily, it has to take 6 months, and you got to do this, that, and the other thing. So by saying that it hadn't even started, the Democrats were just reeling having heard that. I asked the State Department about that, and they more or less confirmed it in their answer without confirming it. But do you have any sense of, like, why Biden would continue this malicious policy, given the impossibility of him winning Florida? He'll be lucky to come within 10 points in Florida. So it's hard to say that the Miami Cubans down there are so central to his political strategy that he has to just drive this country into the ground for them. Like, what is your sense as the kind of Cuba watcher of why Biden just has refused to buck Trump on this? Just jealousy of Obama or something?
I don't think that anyone has a clear-cut answer just yet. I can give my theory, but I do think this is a case where we need a Bob Woodward-style deep dive into, like, the deep politics of it, because I'm sure it's a very complicated story. But my big theories on this are, number one, the curse of Cuba since 1991. It doesn't matter enough. It doesn't matter enough for Biden to use his precious political capital, time, and energy, and also potentially risk turning Florida even more red to do it. I don't think he cares enough is like number one. He's got domestic and foreign issues that are far higher on his list. And that's not unique to Biden. It's something that has kind of plagued Cuba since 1981, because like I said to your listeners, after 1981, Cuba gets off the front burner, gets on the back burner, and that's why Florida has such a lock on it, because not enough people care to reverse the policy, even if most people, even in the State Department, know that as a policy, it doesn't make much sense. Number two, it was only a few months into Biden being in office when July 11th happened, the protests, the massive protests and the state response to them. And that made Cuba radioactive for a while, because if he starts to do a reform in the middle of that context, he could be seen as being soft on communism or whatever. And so it looks bad, and Cuba was already not a priority, so they just put it into not a priority, but even lower on the list. I think that that's kind of started to change. Sometimes there's been movements here and there to kind of slowly bring back some stuff from the Obama era, but I think it's been much more transactional. I think part of it is the fact that Cuba has had allowed a large number of people to migrate through Nicaragua to the U.S. via Mexico, to the point that the traditional triangle of immigrants, which is Mexico and Central America or whatever, were displaced at one point. I'm not sure if it's still true, but were displaced at one point by Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba. So immigration has kind of pulled Biden back to the table. And that was, I think, part of the intent of that strategy on the part of the Cuban government. It's like, and it's an older strategy. We will collaborate with you on immigration, on drug stuff, on this and that and another thing, as long as you're reasonable with us. And if you guys aren't reasonable with us, we have no reason to help you out on your priorities either, right? This brings me to point three, which is I don't think Biden sees this as part of his legacy. He sees it, seems to treat it as that's Obama's legacy, right? You know, and it's kind of come to become a problem. So he's trying to kind of distance himself from it and be very transactional, but I don't think he sees it either as a priority or as something he really needs to or wants to burn political capital on, since it can be reversed again in the future. And, you know, it becomes a cycle of, you know, like two different people sharing a wheel, and they drive right and they drive left and nothing gets done. So it's kind of back to the back burner, I guess.
And no government is perfect, I'm sure. You know, the current Cuban government could make some different decisions, but how much room do they have? Like, what could they do, you think, differently within the context of these, you know, lawsuits by Americans around the world, the state sponsor of terror designation, the Treasury sanctions, the embargo? What policy room for maneuver do they have that they're not using?
There are very clear reforms that they could do here that I think that would make life better. One of them is they really just need to give up on the ag model, the agricultural model that they've been using for years. It doesn't work. They really have to shift to something like the Vietnamese or Chinese models, or, you know, adapt it to Cuban conditions, but do it. Because, and they've been doing experiments for years on a more like market-oriented economy, and don't just have this system where you have to produce so much and everything above this quota can sell for the market, but everything under this quota you have to sell to us at a price we determine. Like, that model just does not work flat out. And you've got to liberalize the agriculture. You've got to shift to a small farmer model where people own the land again and then can reinvest in it and then can import directly, not having to depend on the state and its institutions, fuel, tractors, inputs, that kind of thing, that they can potentially also export and get hard currency for that. I think that that would be a huge help, because Cuba is an extremely agriculturally rich island. 70% of it is arable, 90% of it in a pinch. Like, that is an insane surface area to arable ratio. And there is no good reason why Cuba needs to be importing 60 to 80% of its food, especially when it doesn't even export sugar anymore. Now, with all that said, I think that's like a clear example of a domestic reform that they need to do. But on the other end, part of the problem, I think, is there's a lot of reforms that would have been extremely delicate and extremely difficult, even under the best circumstances, and like political reforms, and they were put off, and they were put off, and they were put off, and now to do them under these circumstances might be seen as a repeat of what happened in the USSR, right? What is the lesson a lot of these socialist countries drew from Gorbachev? Gorbachev's reformed the economy and politics at the same time. He also mismanaged the economic reforms. People were very miserable. They were discontented, blah, blah, blah. But if you first reform the economy, maybe then you can reform the political system with people who are, by and large, if not in love with the system, at the very least, they're like, I can work with this. I don't want change because, you know, change can be scary. you know, this is the devil I know, whatever, right? But now, how do you do those kind of really deep political reforms or seeming potentially dangerous economic reforms in ways that, like, don't just fuel the fire? That is, I think, the kind of the catch-22 that they're in right now.
And the Soviet leadership also thought that if they kind of surrendered in the Cold War and did these reforms that the West wanted, that the West would embrace them and lavish, like, a new Marshall Plan, basically, on the post-Soviet world, which was just a fundamental misreading of the West's posture toward Russia. Like, we were not going to suddenly turn them into friends. It was much more intractable. You know, they believed that it was ideological, and it was obviously partly ideological, but it was also just, you know, geopolitical and, you know, imperial. And so I would imagine that the Cuban leadership understands the same thing, that just giving up is going to lead to probably the same looting that you saw, you know, post-Soviet collapse.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's pair.com.
A recent article for NACLA is headlined, Haiti as Empire's Laboratory. Professor Pierre, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you start off by describing what you understand is the latest on the ground, who the armed groups are, and the different sectors of Haitian society that are joining together with those armed gangs and calling for the resignation of the unelected Prime Minister Henri?
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me, Amy. One of the things that we need to just start off with is just these are paramilitary forces. I think gangs is an insufficient name for them because a lot of them are former military and former police officers, and they're heavily armed. What's happening is a bunch of different groups coming together to say, and they call themselves now Vive Ensemble, which is live together, a bunch of different various armed young men in groups to say that they want to get rid of Ayo Henri. Now, we hear that there are negotiations happening around the clock, and apparently there's supposed to be negotiations going on today, I think in Jamaica or by the CARICOM countries that include the U.S., France, and Canada. The problem, though, is the fact that there are all these negotiations going on outside of Haiti by many foreigners with no main participation from the Haitian masses. And I think, you know, we have to go back to understand that the root of this crisis is not last week, it's not this week, it's not even Ayo Henri, but we have to go back to 2004 with the coup d'etat.
So take us on that journey back. If you'll give us the historical context in your piece, it's headlined Haiti as Empire's Laboratory. In it, you write, Haiti has been and continues to be the main laboratory for U.S. imperial machinations in the region and throughout the world. Explain.
Yes, definitely. You know, we say the crisis in Haiti is a crisis of imperialism. In 2004, as has been revealed and admitted to, the U.S., France, and Canada got together and backed a coup d'etat against the country's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And the U.S. Marines flew into his home, put him on a plane with his security officials, his wife and aide, and flew them to the Central African Republic. And people can actually go to the Democracy Now! Archives, which covered this live. And I remember listening to this happening live. And the point of this was that this coup d'etat, which was led by two permanent members of the UN Security Council, was then sanctioned by the UN when these same two members of the UN Security Council, and that's US and France, basically pushed the UN Security Council into sending a multinational military force to Haiti, an arm under Chapter 7 deployment. And that itself was illegal because the original coup d'etat was illegal. The US ambassador to Haiti and the deputy ambassador were in the process. They're the ones that named who the interim a president would be, put together a council of sages, and basically restructured Haiti's elected president. And back then we had 7,000 elected officials. Today we have zero. And over time, I say Haiti has been under occupation because it is this military occupation, the minister occupation that went from 2004 2007, that established the core group, that it's an unelected group of Western officials, including Brazil, which led the military arm of the occupation in 2004 under Lula, which led then, which has been controlling all the actions in Haiti, down to naming who the prime minister would be, Ariel Henry, after the assassination of Jovenel Moïse. I have to quickly say, though, one of the key things that happened is in 2010, after the earthquake in Haiti that killed hundreds of thousands, where the U.S. pushed the sitting president, René Préval, to have elections. And in the WikiLeaks papers revealed to us later that Hillary Clinton actually flew to Haiti and changed the election results, where Michel Martelly of the PHTK political party did not make the first round, but the U.S. forced the Haitian Election Council to actually put him in the second round. And so establishing the PHTK, Michel Martelly, a neo-Duvalierist, as Haiti's president, with under 20% of the people voting, with the largest political party in Haiti, La Valas, not being able to participate, we set the stage for what we see today. So by the time we get to Ariel Henry being imposed on the Haitian people by the core group, we have no elected officials because Michel Martelly, basically under him, we lost a lot of, we didn't have many elections. And then he put in his protege, Jovenel Moïse, who was also unpopular and didn't run any elections. So we actually haven't had any elections in Haiti since 2016, when Jovenel Moïse was selected for us by the core group. And so to understand what's going on in Haiti, we have to understand how the original moment of the 2004 coup d'etat led us to the complete destruction of the Haitian state. And if we don't do that, we don't understand these current flare-ups where people are saying they want their democracy back and saying that whatever negotiations that are happening outside of Haiti has nothing to do with them because it has not included them.
We should also probably talk about the intent, too, with the U.S. But what are the mechanisms when they prop up a guy like Henri? What are the mechanisms that are used there? Is it just basically how does that happen? What does that mean? And really, like, is it just basically within Port-au-Prince or is it within 20% of Port-au-Prince? Like, what does it mean for the U.S. To prop up a leader there? And then we should also probably just touch on what is it that they want out of Haiti that it makes it the effort to prop up a leader is expended?
Yeah, the U.S. has been propping up Henri by sending him money. They've been propping him up by providing international diplomatic support and making sure he gets loans from the International Monetary Fund and other international financial institutions. And they've been propping him up by insisting that Henri be in office and be part of Haiti's solution. And what has happened over the last couple of years, Haitian civil society keeps coming up with alternatives, with broad-based platforms that would move Haiti towards fair elections. the U.S. keeps giving Henri a veto by saying, well, he has to be part of it or we're not going to let it work. And what that does is it completely distorts all of the incentives. Henri, as long as he has U.S. supporting, he has support, he has no incentive to compromise towards fair elections because he could never win fair elections. And by not compromising, he's been able to stay in office for 30 months, which is the longest prime ministerial term in at least 40 years in Haiti. So basically, with no constitutional or popular support, he's Haiti's longest serving prime minister because he got the U.S. support. Another big part of how the U.S. has been supporting him, back in 2021, when there were widespread protests against Henri's rule, he called for an international force basically to prop him up. The U.S. has been trying very hard to make that work ever since. And it hasn't yet happened, but there's currently a proposed and UN Security Council authorized mission led by Kenya that is, you know, the U.S. is still trying to get it to come to Haiti. And the U.S. actually made accepting that force a condition of anybody who wanted to play a role in the in Haiti's government after Henri resigns.
All right. So as far as, like, you know, what's been going on with this, in fact, Henri was in Kenya. Is that not right? Just 24 hours ago, that's where he was heading back, and he's been out of the country. But the idea is that the U.S. is basically saying, and Kenya and Haiti had no relations. And
they not had diplomatic relations September. No relations at all. Yeah.
So it was basically the U.S. shopping around for for an African country so that it would ostensibly be black soldiers in Haiti. One who had a competent enough military that also was interested in U.S. aid. So the U.S. is going around saying, like, "Hey, you to come in and basically be our proxy military so that we won't have white faces down there with guns telling the Haitians what to do. You will be our military. We will pay you." And there were problems in Kenya with this because there was a lot of Kenyans who were like, "We don't want to do this, but the U.S. is coming in with an offer you can barely refuse."
Yep. And the U.S. first tried to get Canada. Canada refused and said, "This is a bad idea. It's not going to work propping up a hated government." They asked CARICOM, the Caribbean countries. They refused. They asked Brazil. Brazil refused. They asked countries in West Africa. They refused. And it was really Kenya, who had no interest in Haiti, but did have interest in hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars, that finally got Kenya to agree. But once they agreed, Kenya sent an exploratory mission to see what was happening. The exploratory mission said, "No, we're not going to do that. We're going to revise the mission to where it's much less combative." The U.S. said no, wrong answer, and forced them to retake it. Just in the last 2 hours, we've heard another report that Kenya is saying, "Well, maybe we're not going to do it after all." We don't know if they're just trying to get more money out of the U.S. or they're serious about pulling out. That's a developing story.
There are a few things that I will say here that will require folks to go and dig to understand further what supports these assertions. For instance, the first thing I'd say is that what we are watching is an international crime scene. Okay, that doesn't mean the local actors are not really doing what they're doing. But if you're only looking at the local actors, you will not understand what is happening. Because, of course, like, it is surreal. Like, how could a small group of criminals hold a whole country hostage like that for so long? Okay. And the only reason that it happens is because they are not really alone. Their backing is from powerful states, the United States, Canada, Europe, and they're playing both sides of this conflict. Another thing people need to realize is that although you've heard that the so-called gangs, which are really paramilitaries, they are U.S. armed militias, have been fighting Henri's government, there's been no casualties on either side. Okay? None of the big gang leaders have fallen, and no member of Henri's government have been hit, or Henri himself. In reality, the game that's being played here is to force decent Haitians who want to establish a social justice reform program in their country to accept accommodation with the criminals that have been running the country for the past couple of decades. Now, this is a way to say it very briefly, but when you go and look into the details to talk about the forces that are really making decisions in Haiti, a name that people need to Google and search is the CORE Group. The CORE Group is an informal structure, but don't let the word informal fool you, because they make all the real decisions in what's happening in Haiti. It's composed of the ambassadors of the United States, Canada, France, Germany, Brazil, the representative of OAS, the Organization of American States, and the United Nations. Now, someone might ask, you know, what does Germany, you know, Brazil, what do they have to do with, you know, France, for crying out loud? Well, it's because Haitian independence has never been accepted, okay? And it's not, and another term they usually, improper term they usually use for the CORE Group when they're talking about the decisions of the CORE Group. For instance, the CORE Group is the entity that named Ariel Henry prime minister. Okay, it's not any Haitian entity. They published a tweet and that's how he became prime minister. And it sounds surreal, but that's how it's been happening. So people need to understand that Haiti is under occupation. That's the reality. And if you compare it with the 1915 to 1934 occupation of Haiti, there is no real difference in how it happened, in the sense that the occupiers pretend that, no, there's no occupation. Haiti has a president. We had a president back in 1915. Our president even declared war to Japan. Well, another one was so bold, he declared war to Japan, Italy, and Germany at the same time. Of course, what it meant was that the U.S. had declared war to these countries, and since the U.S. occupied Haiti, the fool that they had imposed as president of Haiti, you know, issued statements of solidarity with the American position. So people need to understand, the current mess is Haiti under occupation. This is one of the things that they're trying to hide. The fact that the disaster that you are observing is the result of what is called the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti. What is the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti? It's a meeting that took place in the town where I live, Gatineau, Quebec, which is, I guess, a twin town with Ottawa, which is the capital of Canada. There on January 31st, February 1st, 2003, a set of white men and women met, and you will see why I emphasize that it was white men and women. And they had 2 days of discussions on the future of Haiti. Who participated in that meeting? Now their names are known. At the time, it was secret. But you had foreign ministers of France. There was one lady from El Salvador. The other ones were from the United States and from the Organization of American States. Luigi Analgi was there. All white men and women. And they decided that the government of Haiti at the time had to be overthrown, the country put under UN tutelage. And the country was then being led by Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a former priest, a liberation theologian, who came to power for the first time in 1990 when he won the election, a landslide election. Now, the reason why they wanted to overthrow him is that the policies that he was applying in Haiti were what these people consider socialist, really modest reform. He doubled the minimum wage. He and the legislature at the time came up with new laws to protect all children, including the street children, built a lot of schools and things like that, and hospitals. Like, nothing revolutionary, really. But even that was considered unacceptable to whom? To Washington, their cousins in Ottawa and in Paris, but also And importantly, and these people never make it to the front pages of the New York Times or CNN, Radio Canada or BBC, but they are the ones running the economy of Haiti. That's what I call the 15 white mafia families. Okay, the richest person in Haiti does not look like Haitians. The second richest person in Haiti does not look like Haitians. The third, the fourth, the fifth. I mean, I know there are other countries in the Caribbean where that reality can also be observed. But you have to understand, Haiti gained its independence from white supremacy. And there was a law instituted as soon as the revolution was successful to say that no white man shall set foot on this territory as owner. Okay? So that means something must have happened after the revolution to make it so that the richest people on the island are all white.
Well, let's talk about that. Cause this is like you said, like even the sort of like shadow puppet decision-making body that is controlling Haiti now, comprised of white people, like, and it's an international sort of cohort that's determining like what this country and its future and its people is going to be. That is not an exception. That is like basically the struggle that Haitians have been engaged in since the very beginning, right? Since the slave revolt.
That's right.
For freedom in Haiti, for which the white Western world has never forgiven Haiti. And it's shown even from the time that the revolution was won, and immediately Haiti was slapped with trade embargoes from the United States. It was paying just, you know, for over half a century, all of its wealth back to France for the crime of claiming independence. It was occupied by the United States less than a century ago. Like you said, like this, you cannot understand the crisis you're watching now, the poverty, the violence, any of that you're watching now, only looking at like the sort of local context and trying to piece something together. You cannot tell this story without like telling the other side of the story about how Haiti has been pillaged and punished since its beginnings.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Now, the next thing I want to move on and kind of do a little bit of a topic shift here. The Black Alliance for Peace and other partner organizations have launched what is called the Zone of Peace campaign. Can you kind of tell us what that is, what its core demands are, and what its objectives are?
Yes, I can. This January 29th makes 10 years since the heads of states and governments of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, which is CELAC, met in Havana, Cuba, and declared Latin America and the Caribbean that they should be seen and respected as a zone of peace. But again, it's been 10 years, and this declaration from government representatives has not translated into a people-centered movement across the region. So on April 4th of 2023, BAP, alongside key partner organizations, launched the Zone of Peace campaign in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, Washington, D.C., and Havana, Cuba. And this was an effort to activate the popular movement element of this state-centered declaration by reinvigorating the declaration and building support across the region. So we are committed to building an international zone of peace in our Americas. informed by the Black radical peace tradition, which is an understanding that peace is not the absence of conflict, but the achievement, rather, by popular struggle and self-defense of a world liberated from nuclear armament and proliferation, unjust war, and global white supremacy. So as part of this, we understand the extent of U.S. imperialism in the Americas and work to join our peoples in the organizations in a coordinated anti-militarist, anti-imperialist struggle and push for people-centered human rights. And what PCHR is, it's a way to help guide how we can maneuver through the rhetorical hypocrisy of the West's use of human rights, because it's a politic of being whole. So this framework is an approach that views human rights as an area or an arena, rather, of struggle that, when grounded and informed by the needs and aspirations of the oppressed, becomes part of the unified comprehensive strategy for decolonization and radical change. And it distinguishes itself from the erroneous and prevalent use of the West human rights by requiring an epistemological break with a human rights orthodoxy grounded in Eurocentric liberalism. It's a reconceptualization of human rights from the standpoint of oppressed peoples, a restructuring of prevalent social relationships that perpetuate oppression, and the acquiring of power on the part of the oppressed to bring about that restructuring. So again, BAP is leading this effort to revive the civil society element of the state-centered declaration by popularizing the declaration and building popular support across the region. And the objectives, of course, is to build a people-centered campaign that coordinates anti-imperialist, anti-war, pro-peace organizations, political parties, labor and social justice organizations, as well as movements across the region to move our Americas towards building alternative institutions and centers of power. We also want to strengthen an America's wide consciousness among the peoples of the region, which includes making sure that people within the U.S., Africans in particular, especially in the southern region, understand ourselves as part and parcel of the Americas, and establishing a people-centered America's wide coordinating structures that will facilitate the successful expulsion of the U.S., EU, NATO access of domination from our region. And this includes Operation Tradewinds, which is military combatant activities that occur across the Caribbean, training that is partnered with NATO nations like France, like the Netherlands, like Canada. Most recently, they just held one in Guyana, I believe. Also the Global Fragilities Act and, you know, other soft power institutions like NED and the USAID, which, you know, is very busy in areas like Cuba, Nicaragua, etc. And then some of the initial core demands are to dismantle SOUTHCOM and the U.S. NATO military exercises, disband U.S. Sponsored state terrorist training facilities, like the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. And for those who don't know, that's formerly the School of the Americas. And a lot of what we do in this campaign is liking that to COP City and the training facility, COP City, and the type of training that will be occurring is very similar to how we understand the School of the Americas. Also, opposing military intervention in Haiti and the return of Guantanamo to Cuba. So those are just a few of the initial demands that we have for the Zone of Peace. Most recently, there was a strategic meeting held in Colombia to discuss how do we move this forward. This was done with a plethora of grassroots organizations across the Americas in nations like Nicaragua, in nations like Brazil, the U.S., obviously, we had Guyana representatives. So a lot of what we did there as well was leave with a declaration in support of Haiti, in support of the self-sovereignty and self-determination, and sort of reasserting an emphasis on the call of the Zone of Peace from the CELAC community.
There is a statement that I'm going to share with you that came from a meeting that a set of Haitians from many different cities organized the other day, which essentially summarizes what we are looking for. And so essentially, this is a group that is organizing demonstrations in the coming months, and this would be Global Days of Solidarity with Haiti. They're planning three coming up at the end of March, April, and May. And they say, we declare the Haitian people's sovereign right on their territory is absolute and sacred. Foreigners who violate this right are enemies of the nation. Haitians who help the enemy to violate Haitian sovereignty are traitors who will be punished as our ancestors and the laws of our country command. And to support this declaration, I added three bullet points. A, the core group, which is the ambassadors of foreign countries, is declared persona non grata. Kenyan, Senegalese, CARICOM, Spanish, and other mercenaries better remain in their own territories. Michel Martelly, Gilbert Bidjo, Reynold Dib, Johnson André or Izo, Dimitri Erard, Jimmy Cherizier Barbecue, Vitelom Innocent, André Aped, Guy Philippe, all criminals who broke prison walls and spilled the blood of innocent people must get arrested or be punished. The only transitional government we will recognize is one that comes from Haitian leaders who do not have the blood of the people on their hands. So this is to support the first declaration. The second declaration states, to defend the life of honest Haitians, we will fight against all wickedness until we disarm all criminals, foreigners, and Haitians alike, and rebuild the legitimate defense forces of our nation. To support this declaration, we have decreed ongoing mobilization to rebuild all legal forces, police and army, established to guarantee safety for everyone on our homeland as required without discrimination. B, abolish all private militias that currently protect and serve criminal oligarchs, white imperialist forces, and their accomplices. C, we seek due application of international law to force the United States and the Dominican Republic to stop invading Haiti with deadly weapons, while these countries are harboring major criminals who have Haitian blood on their hands in their territory, in particular Gilbert Bidjo and Michel Martelly. And three, the third declaration, we declare relentless mobilization to expose and counter all malicious forces which gangsterized Haiti with the PHTK militias. To support this declaration, we demand restitution and reparations from the governments of core group member countries, the United Nations, the OAS, for multiple crimes they've committed against the Haitian people in history, as well as in the present era. B, we open our arms to receive and offer solidarity to all struggling peoples, such as those of Cuba, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, Palestine, Venezuela, who are facing the malicious actions of the same clan of colonizers, land thieves, who form the core group. Stand for Haiti, Judge Bill Clinton, justice, dignity, reparations for Haiti. So this is the statement. And in the document that will be on the web, people will be able to click on the names of the people that we've identified in this document to find out what is the charge against these individuals.
We've just heard clips today, starting with Revolutionary Left Radio looking at the impacts of the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Deconstructed, in two parts, dove into some of the details of the embargo, followed by proposed reforms that may help Cuba. Democracy Now! Looked at the historical context of Haiti that helps explain the paramilitary action happening now. The Majority Report explained the U.S. involvement in sending military aid from Kenya to Haiti. The Real News laid out the legacy of the Ottawa Initiative and the history of wealth inequality in Haiti. Rev Left Radio discussed the Zone of Peace campaign, and The Real News shared the Haiti statement on self-determination. That's what everybody heard, but members also heard bonus clips from Revolutionary Left Radio sharing more experiences from the blockade in Cuba, and Bad Faith described the background of the paramilitary leader in Haiti. To hear that and have all of our bonus content delivered seamlessly to the new members-only podcast feed that you'll receive, sign up to support the show at bestofleft.com/support or shoot me an email requesting a financial hardship membership, because we don't let a lack of funds stand in the way of hearing more information. Now to wrap up, I just want to point out that talk of civil and political unrest in poor nations is often received by Americans, I think, with a sense of sort of pity and maybe gratitude that we're not in danger of such scenarios ourselves. And it's still true that the U.S. and Haiti are on opposite ends of the power and wealth spectrum, but there's really no cause to be overconfident right now. There's been a steady drumbeat in the last few years from the far right calling for a civil war, and renewed calls from the pretty much regular right for some states to start seceding from the nation again. After January 6th, the idea of political violence in the U.S. in the modern era cannot be considered merely hypothetical anymore. But the most dangerous underlying factor has been with us for a long time and has been getting significantly worse in the past 15 years. Out-of-control wealth inequality, coupled with campaign finance that has basically legalized corruption to its core. In an effectively failed state like Haiti, corruption looks a lot more like you think it does, with the wealthy kleptocrats pocketing aid money to fund their European villas and the like. The result is an impoverished country with a governing structure that doesn't represent the will or interest of the people. In the U.S., corruption is legalized through campaign finance, so oligarchs receive their money through legitimate businesses, but then use their wealth to control the government to minimize needed taxation and regulation to make their businesses as wildly profitable as possible. The result in the U.S. is on a different scale than Haiti, but the unresponsiveness to the public is similar and has been shown in studies that track the greater likelihood of legislation passing if it's supported by the rich rather than if it's supported by simply a majority of the population. And although we still can't be considered a poor nation, we certainly allow people to remain impoverished, and we spend huge amounts of money on things that do not help our own people, while allowing millions to, for instance, go bankrupt from healthcare costs. This disconnect between government and governed is the same basic mechanism that spurs most uprisings that seek to violently overthrow an existing power structure. The pattern can be seen in our own founding revolution through to Haiti's current paramilitary violence. The violence endemic to unstable countries shouldn't be focused on as pitiable, but rather as a warning. This is what can happen when the political structure is allowed to be seen as illegitimate by the population. Whether because it was installed by a coup or propped up by foreign powers, as in Haiti, or because the Supreme Court has legalized political corruption on a level never before seen in the U.S. Remember, before Donald Trump was riding a wave of authoritarian, xenophobic support, one of his primary arguments in the 2016 election was the corruption of all of the other candidates and his supposed incorruptibility thanks to his extreme wealth. It was an argument that was both laughable because it was coming from Trump, but it was also based in a widespread, deeply held, extremely legitimate belief that money in politics has corrupted the fundamentals of our democracy and some major change is needed. Now, for some who voted for Trump, they may have thought that he was the answer. I certainly never thought that, but I agreed with the sort of desperation for a major change. So when I think of the current threat of political violence from right-wing fever dreams of a new civil war and the dangers facing our election system from conspiracy theorists who consider any electoral loss to be illegitimate, I recognize that those issues are extremely urgent and need to be addressed first, but I really don't want to lose sight of the underlying causes that have brought us to this point. And when I think of the breakdown of political functionality anywhere, Haiti, Cuba, or elsewhere, I think there, but for the perpetually sustained efforts to maintain a functioning democracy, go us. That is going to be it for today. As always, keep the comments coming in. I would love to hear your thoughts or questions about this or anything else. You can leave a voicemail or send us a text at 202-999-3991 or simply email me to j@bestofleft.com. Thanks to everyone for listening. Thanks to Dion Clark and Aaron Clayton for their research work for the show and participation in our bonus episodes. Thanks to our transcriptionist quartet, Ken, Brian, Ben, and Andrew for their volunteer work helping put our transcripts together. Thanks to Amanda Hoffman for all of her work behind the scenes and her bonus show co-hosting, and thanks to all those who already support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships. You can join them by signing up today at bestoftheleft.com/support, through our Patreon page, or from right inside the Apple Podcasts app. Membership is how you get instant access to our incredibly good and often funny bonus episodes, in addition to there being extra content, no ads, and chapter markers in all of our regular episodes, all through your regular podcast player. You'll find that link in the show notes, along with a link to join our Discord community, where you can also continue the discussion. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show from bestoftheleft.com.